and follow the procedures as closely as I can. The first thing I'm supposed to do is remind you that attendance at any session of the symposium is by name tag or a ticket. Now, I've done that. Regarding Dr. Burton Shaw, he has a lifetime of achievements. He has a PhD in political science. He's been a teacher, a president of a college, a vice president of a university, a city councilman, a legislator, a lobbyist, a farmer, and a businessman. He's pretty well covered the spectrum. I met Claude in a political science class at Ricks College, Political Science 101, back in 1958. And our paths haven't crossed for a number of years. I feel it a great privilege to be able to chair this session of the Sunstone Symposium. My memories of Claude connect him with a lot of ironies. He was a Democrat teaching at Ricks College, and there were few of them. And I remember him discussing his research for his master's thesis in the classes I took from him. And he pointed out that the conservative Republicans in Idaho Falls thought that public power was good for Idaho Falls, but it was not good for the rest of the state of Idaho. Another professor at Ricks College privately voiced to a number of us students a concern for Claude's political views. He was afraid it would affect Claude's testimony. About a decade later, that professor was excommunicated from the church, and I don't know, recall that he came back in. But Claude remains what I think President Kimball termed a dialogue Mormon. I believe by that President Kimball meant a Mormon who believes in the restoration, but he's also a Mormon who has no compunction about exploring the folklore that has grown up around the restoration. I believe that having 8 children and 42 grandchildren demonstrate Claude's commitment to the basics of Mormonism. In his paper, Religious Freedom and the Secular Constitution, I see Claude involved in yet another irony. It took a divine intervention to disestablish religion, to sever the two-edged sword partnership between church and state that had persisted since the end of the 5th century. Apparently, God did not like the doctrine of the two-edged sword and inspired the framers of the U.S. Constitution to change it. I found Claude's paper well thought out and convincing. Claude hopes that there will be time for questions after he presents his paper. I now turn over the time to Claude.
You ought not to applaud until I'm through. That's an odd custom we have, to applaud when the speaker's announced, unless you think that's the only reason. Applause is necessary. First of all, I'm glad you're here. I didn't even expect this many to show you. I mean, the interest in this kind of topic must not be much. But I'm pleased you came. And I will try to do something with my topic. If you will notice my paper, it's terribly big, and I'm sure you can't tolerate my doing much with it. So I hope I can interest you in it, and if you had any concern at all, I'll make one available to you at the end. The church has been involved in politics all its life, and its involvement has been a strange kind. It has had many disappointments with the political institution. In fact, to claim that the Constitution is a divinely inspired one seems to suggest that the church ought to like it and that it supports it somehow or other. But almost all of its confrontation, almost all has been a confrontation with the system, and it failed in most of them. They were almost destined to be in conflict from the beginning. Let me just suggest for a second as I introduce my paper. I'm talking about two control institutions. Both of them seem to want total, absolute control over the same membership. That must be the beginning of the problem. Note how a revelation in 1831 begins the introduction to the Doctrine and Covenants. That's our official scripture. Note what it begins in that section. The voice of the Lord is unto all men, and there is none to escape. And there is no eye that shall not see, neither ear that shall not hear, neither heart that shall not be penetrated, and the rebellious shall be pierced with sorrow. Now the new scripture contains the behavioral requirements of the members, and it has as its authority, says in that same section, this is mine, the Lord's authority, and the authority of my servant. Now that was to Joseph Smith, and that still holds to this day. The Constitution of the United States, written 42 years earlier, declared this: the Constitution and all law made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. The document claims as its authority, you note that in the preamble, we the people. Those are the basis of the two control mechanism, both claiming this totality of control over the same members. You'll note that those two statements seem to be the legitimizing statements for both institutions. Any problems in the United States system, you have to determine its constitutionality. Any problems in the church system, you go to the highest of the authority, which was God speaking in the case of those two statements, or of that statement. Now, what raised the question for me were three articles that appeared last October in the Ensign. They were written by Brother Oaks, Dallin Oaks, Elder Oaks, Elder Russell Ballard, and Elder James Faust. All three of the articles were somehow or other lamenting their inaccessibility to the political system. And the basis they claimed, concern they have, is that the Constitution somehow or other has been misinterpreted or has been used to exclude religion or religious leaders from the political system. Elder Oaks makes it very clear in his that you can't have a sound or a stable political system unless you admit the absolute values that are apparent only in Judeo-Christian scriptures. Those values, he say, are the absolute basis for sound political principles and good law. Elder Ballard, he says that the basis of the United States Constitution, he uses constitutional law, is God's inspiration, that is, God's will, wrote the Constitution, and it becomes the basis of constitutional law. And therefore, all morality, all political morality, rests upon God's morality. Elder Faust, he's very much concerned that has become completely secular, and to him secularity removes all religion from the system. And therefore, he says, that thing that makes a political system civil, respected, and causes some obedience to the whole system is in that faith that you have that the system is religiously inspired. And so to him, making the system secular was a way of taking the religion out and threatening the structure of the whole system. Those three articles then to me said, and each of them mentioned the word secular, each of them suggested then that the secular idea that excluded religious leaders from the system was the evil, was the something that was bad in American political politics. That caught my attention. My concern was whether, I guess I should say, I agreed with them that the system was secular. I may not agree as to when or how it became secular or what secularity meant. Secularity then and religion to them, and as I will use it, seems to suggest that they're diametrically opposed or they're not the same. Not necessarily that that the Constitution is anti-religious. All I'm going to contend is that the Constitution was secular from the beginning, and there is no place in it that allowed for any kind of religious intervention. It was moved out at the beginning and has maintained all the way through. Just a minute now. I've got a long period of my paper now that I want to summarize, if I can, very quickly. To understand secularity, I think, you need to understand Christian religion, because Christianity makes a difference to secularity. Christianity, we would go to Jesus to understand what it was that he was up to, and he had the same kind of problem. He created, supposedly, his kingdom in a Jewish Roman kingdom in which he had to contend with secular power, Caesar. The writers, the two, Matthew and Luke, they explore this seeming confrontation with statements from Pharisees who wants to know, what about Caesar? What about paying tribute to him? And Luke, he was concerned with, when will this kingdom come, which the Jews wanted to come? The Jews wanted a kingdom that would save them or to reclaim them from their Roman captivity. Well, that seems to be set up, and Jesus seemed to develop his quite apart from the state, or from the secular institution, the state, and seemed to pursue it. Caesar's kingdom could not be left out by his enemies. They brought it in and eventually destroyed Jesus. Jesus, though, had built his kingdom on something quite different, as Luke reported it, a kingdom from within. Running fast across then, it took about 200, 300 years for the Christians to finally be brought in by some believing, well, Constantine in 325, brought in Christianity, and by another 100 years, Christianity had become the state religion. And at the end of the 5th century, about 476, 480, somewhere along in there, Pope Galatius, the Roman Pope Galatius, established as the official state religion. I just wanted to have you see that very quickly so you can see what it is we're talking about. Early in the 4th century, a change came with the acceptance of Christianity by an emperor, and soon after it became the state religion. The secular state then attempted to acknowledge and use spiritual concerns and the power of the church. It became the political ideology. It justified worldly punishment. Near the end of the 5th century, the state-church relationship changed significantly. Church leaders had become politically powerful, so much so that the Bishop of Rome, Pope Galatius I, defined the relationship by a proclamation, making the Christian religion a partner of the secular state. The proclamation is referred to as the Two-Sword Doctrine. Let me just paraphrase here very quickly what that doctrine said. This is written by Galatius, in Latin, of course, but here is the English paraphrase. Society is governed by two authorities, church and state, whose joint purpose is to share the management of the earthly affairs of life so that every soul can be saved in heaven. The state is to keep the peace and order through the proper conduct of civil government. The church is to teach the true doctrine of salvation and provide for spiritual needs. Conflicts between the two jurisdictions can easily be resolved, this is Galatius still speaking, by the Pope's spiritual assignments. Since God's church is in charge of individual salvation, the emperor, also an individual church member, is subordinated to the church and its leaders. Thus, conflicts are resolvable and the two kingdoms are compatible. The doctrine, however, didn't provide much success. The two kingdoms then became rivals at times, and for 1,000 years, church and state relationships were hard to distinguish, and most of the time, the church could use the state to achieve its end. And that 1,000 years were real warfare in which Christians using the state looked like when the state was using the church. I mean, there was seemingly no way to distinguish them. The long period of time that we spanned in that period seemed to not diminish the claim or the seeming need of a state to justify its behavior with Christianity. Now, the whole economic arrangement changed significantly through that whole period. We moved from a feudal to a market-type system. The whole political structure disintegrated, and out of it came the Reformation. And the Reformation then helped in the fragmentation of the political system of Western Europe, and those reformers, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, Knox, all of those, they simply contributed with the two-sword doctrine about how to legitimize political power. I wanted to not say very much about the state until I get toward the end. But when we get to that point where it makes a difference to the American system, we then reach the colonization and the impact of the Reformation on England. And out of that came the development of our 13 colonies that moved into the eastern seaboard, set up the colonies, and the two-sword doctrine crossed the ocean and became quite significant in different degrees to most of the colonies. The colonies, too, had all kinds of problems, and in those, what developed most was a diverse religious, almost every one of the Protestant churches found their place in the colonies and established the two-sword kind of relationship in one form or another. The most critical kind of relationship that we remember and know about is the one that led up to the revolution. And the revolution was about a relationship between Parliament, King, and the mother country through charters, which gave land, gave authority to land and also the controls. This diversity that developed in church, in the frontier kind of development, and now I must mention there also migrated across the sea during this early period, was the Enlightenment movement. It wound up in the early universities of the colonies. This broad spectrum then of diversity, variety of descent and so on, all of these then seemed to contribute to the revolution and to what happened after the successful revolt of the colonies. And when they finished and had severed their ties, their political ties with Britain, they now were ready to deal with each other in some sort of fashion that would bring greatest security to them. Not sure just how we would assess the religious political relationships at this point. They were quite diverse. But they were nonetheless very present in all that was going on, and still the two-sword doctrine still seemed to suggest that a political institution needs some sort of justification for what and how it behaves. But the Constitutional Convention then that met those five or six after the success of the revolution met because of the precarious conditions of the 13 colonies. Their security seemed to be threatened from three or four or five different ways. And so some nationalists, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Gouverneur Morris, James Wilson, just to mention some, they pursued the Congress under the Articles of Confederation, the very loose arrangement. They pursued what was seemed to me necessary to have a convention to talk about increasing the power of the central government so that they then could become more secure. The unity was thought to be the critical item. Well, these men who were nationalists finally got the convention called, and on that May 29th day, you remember, in 1787, they were there, and they began their work. Their work is stated in the very first motion when enough delegates arrived to pursue it. The very first motion was that this government, this national government, should adopt a supreme legislative, executive, and a judicial system. That motion carried 5-1 with one tied vote. The convention then was on its way. And what I'm saying is that secularity began at the call of the convention and in the convention. That was a system then that was going to establish a supreme system. When I use the word supreme here, I mean that it found in itself its source of power. Didn't go outside of itself. And when they got through writing the Constitution so said it. The Constitution in Article 6 says, "This Constitution and all laws and treaties made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land." What was omitted was any reference to religion. There is no reference to religion anywhere in the whole document. It only finds power in itself, and it excluded all other sources of power it founded. That was a tremendously powerful kind of claim, with secularity as the only source, meaning here and now. It looked almost identical to the one that Jesus wrestled with in Caesar. The Constitution then, we'll say, was trying to create something that had power in itself. This was a kind of threatening thing, And when they finally got it distributed out to the 13 colonies for ratification, that was the fear, that it was too powerful and they could not control it. They wanted a Bill of Rights added. A Bill of Rights, it was said, by the time they got through ratifying it, the two big states, Virginia and New York, they were not about to do it until they got the Bill of Rights. But New Hampshire, right in the middle, ratified, making the ninth state, and that was the end. So Virginia and New York could only claim that we won't support you anyway unless you add a Bill of Rights. When the Bill of Rights was added in 1789 by Madison, it was for the purpose of appeasing those states who thought they needed a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights then was added by James Madison. He was in the Congress by this time, and he presented it, got it through Congress, got out to all the states, and when we celebrated in 1991, we celebrated the ratification of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights then was an appeasement to the states. The first line of the Bill of Rights says, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So if we thought the document somehow or other included religion, that amendment made it clear it did not. And so when the system was all through, the Bill of Rights was there, all of these first 10 amendments, then we had a clear statement that religion had no access to the system. It was completely left out. This is a hard thing to say to a Latter-day Saint group. We've heard for all our lives that somehow or other God wrote the thing, and it was written for our benefit, and it was written to promote Mormonism in the land. I want very quickly now just to run across and let you see that notion of secularity, which is non-religious, which does not permit any kind of religious interference, has held in that document right up to 1992, when the last Supreme Court decision determined what it was. And I'm saying then that the Constitution was intended to be the supreme law of the land without any external. That is, it was removing God, it removed morality, it removed natural law. None of those had any place in it, because the system provided its own process of determining not only secularity, but supremacy. The supreme idea then that it was to be, the Constitution and the laws that were made in pursuance thereof, were to be the supreme law of the land. The Constitution never made any preparation, made no provisions for enforcing this supreme law. Who should do it? Well, a couple of the men at the convention who wrote the Federalist Papers and who wrote an anti-Federalist paper, they were sure the Supreme Court would handle this kind of thing like they interpreted all laws. And so they did. They assumed the role. In 1796, the first case that came before the Supreme Court was to question the constitutionality of a law, a tax that Congress had provided on carriages, incidentally. And that law was upheld to be constitutional by the Supreme Court. In 1803, another law became an issue before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional, establishing then a precedent. Now, the other concerns were these states out there, those 13 states. What happened to them in the process? It became rather clear in the Constitution that the national government was to be supreme, meaning the states would be subordinated. Well, a state wrote a tax law, tax the bank, that the federal government had created, and that got to the Supreme Court, and the court said in 1819 that states can't tax a federal institution, and it declared a state's law unconstitutional. Everything went quite well, and it seemed that the Constitution was in shape to be the supreme law when we get to the 1861, when the Civil War, or when South Carolina rebelled and was ready to pull out, which they did just after Lincoln's election. Lincoln said to South Carolina and the other 10 states who had withdrawn, "You can't do that. That's unconstitutional." So he intervened with the military, and when he got through in 1865, the Constitution was supreme, and clearly the nationalist kind of thing that those men met in Philadelphia to establish. So now we have it clear there is a national law called the Constitution that is imposed upon everybody in the system, and the Supreme Court now is in place to be the final interpreter of what the Constitution means, and now it's very clear. Constitutional law is the decisions of the Supreme Court. They make constitutional law. That's the origin of it. Well, we have pretty well established, then, we'll say, by 1865. In the meantime, the church has had some experience with the Constitution and with constitutional law. They, as you remember, were in their activity running head-on into the law, or to other people and the law, from its beginning. In 1831, they moved out on the frontier, out into Missouri, and by 1833 they had been removed from Jackson County. And in that period, 2 months after that removal of Jackson County, the revelation that tells us that God raised up men to write the Constitution, that seemingly he approved of something in the Constitution that related to freedom or to the responsibility for your own acts. Those are paraphrases of the word in the 98th and the 101st section of the Doctrine and Covenants. That didn't seem to make any difference to the Latter-day Saints' claim for protection for their religious freedom. They were driven from Ohio, from Missouri, and from Illinois with confrontations in the constitutional system. Quite unexplained, we know. I mean, quite misunderstood. We think that the United States government ought to have protected the Latter-day Saints in those three states. It did not, because religious freedom was removed from the United States government to the states in the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court had said so by constitutional law in 1833, the very time that the revelation was being received. So there was no impact at all in those states, because the Constitution had no effectiveness in those states. That was Ohio, that was Missouri, that was Illinois' prerogative to deal with religion. Well, when we get through with those, the Latter-day Saints then moved to Utah. In Utah, they did run into the power of the United States to control religion. They were a territory. The states were no longer organized. So in this stateless society, the Latter-day Saints had to deal with the Congress of the United States. And the Congress of the United States, after some problems here in Utah, sent an army in 1857 to settle the disputes, or to conquer the Latter-day Saints who were having these troubles. The Congress also sent an army or some people in there to establish Fort Douglas. What was it, 1861, 62? And they were to be here to give surveillance to the Latter-day Saint under the pretense of helping or protecting the immigrants as they went west. In 1862, the Congress, now with its constitutional authority, wrote a law prohibiting polygamy, and it proceeded to enforce it. The Latter-day Saint said the Constitution protects us in our religious choices, our religious freedom. You cannot regulate our marriages. It took a long while and a change of a couple of national laws. But in 1878, Bishop Reynolds went to court and went to the Supreme Court claiming that belief in polygamy could not be touched because of the constitutional protection. It failed. The Constitution said the Supreme Court, this enforcer of the supreme law of the land, it said it only protects your belief, not your practice. And so you could believe this, but you can't practice polygamy. So Brother Reynolds was put in jail, along with hundreds of others who were there. The next encounter with it was the Congress wrote a law authorizing the confiscation of church property and the distribution of that to charities. Now, says a Brother Romney, and I think there are about two cases here, finally made it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld the Congress in confiscating and distributing the property. That was the crisis for the church. This was about to destroy it completely. And so the manifesto then was issued, and with that there changed a little more favor toward the Utahns, and during this time then of which they were then getting their properties back. Incidentally, B.H. Roberts writes that the church was under the control, the church property was under control of the federal government for 9 years, the time which it was until they got it back. During this time, they sought statehood, and by 1896, they received statehood. But now note what happened to that secular idea, the secular political institution. In this case, then, the... Just wanted to read here just a second. On January 4th, 1896, with a constitution that clearly forbade the church's access to the political system, to the familiar religious exclusion in the U.S. Constitution of forbidding the establishment and the free exercise of religion, the Utah Constitution added the protection of conscience for religious choice, no union of church and state, and the prohibition of the use of public funds for any religious purpose. The restored church was left with only its religious, spiritual purposes. If Utahns doubted, they had any doubts about the repeal of this two-sword doctrine, it became rather clear then that this political system that now included Utah state government, that system now had no religion, had no access to it. So it was saying. We might add then that the church's restored doctrine, written in 1835, which you can read in the 134th section, we do not believe it just to mingle religious influence with civil government. And our 12th article of faith, it says, we believe in being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, and magistrates. The secularity notion is a little more clearly stated in constitutional law, but constitutional law about church-state relationships outside of Utah doesn't get expressed until 1940. That's the first time constitutional law deals with this issue. And it dealt with a law in Connecticut that forbid, without permission, the distribution of religious tracts along the streets. Three Jehovah's Witnesses were picked up for violating the law. It finally made it to the Supreme Court, and supreme and constitutional law said that was an unnecessary burden on religion, stating the free exercise of religion was protected when it was overburdened or unnecessarily burdensome to the church. So the Jehovah Witnesses, like anybody else then, could distribute their tracts uninhibited by the law. In 1947 was the next case, and this is where in New Jersey they had appropriated, the state legislature had appropriated funds to pay for the transportation to parochial schools. This got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld it, saying that this was not a violation of their this was a violation of their constitutional right for the same reason. You could contribute to transportation the same way that you can contribute water, the sewage system and so on, to the church. Well, that opened up then a whole vast field, and in the next, since 1947, since then until now, we must have had 25, 30 cases that have involved church-state relationships. And the most significant one is how they defined, how the court defines this relationship. And they define it, let me just read here rather quickly, so I'm taking too much time. The court has said there are two things that, or maybe three even. It has said that the Establishment Clause, now we must say in this First Amendment there is one that prohibits the establishment of religion and one that prohibits the interference with free exercise. The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment has been before the Supreme Court more frequently than has the Free Exercise Clause. The court, when interpreting the Establishment Clause, has declared that a state law, to be constitutional, must have a secular, that is, not a religious purpose, and in addition to the secularity test is a requirement of neutrality, that is, a law may not favor any church. This has been interpreted to include prayer, Bible reading, posting copies of the Ten Commandments. These are obviously in conflict with the Constitution. To the court, even the most inoffensive school prayer assumes the existence of a God. The central feature in the court's definition of religion. Also, prayer is not neutral. Only the Mormon God revealed the Book of Mormon, and only the Mormon God requires temples, and only the Mormon God implies that God speaks to its prophets. So those are the very notion of it, says the court, violates the implementation of these tests have gone on now for some years. These will only be 10, 15 years old, I guess. The first 1962 would be the first of those. And all I'm saying about these is that constitutional law makes the Constitution secular, just like the idea was from the beginning. I just wanted to very quickly now say that the constitutional law does two other things, or the Constitution, as interpreted by the court, does two other things. Number one, it creates another arena for politics, for where the disputes are brought. The first arena, you remember, the Constitution provided when it created the Congress of the United States. That's where all of our conflicts go, and there they're settled in that arena. Arena meaning a place where combatants meet and have it out. The second arena then is brought by judicial review, where all the losers in the first arena may come back when they can make a constitutional issue. And that test then brings back many of them, and the Supreme Court becomes an arena just like the other. At a later day, we'll say, and at a higher state, when the constitutional supremacy is now interpreted by the court. The third, or I should say the second feature that the judicial review provides is constitutionalism. That's a belief that the Constitution is supreme and that it's a belief in the system. There are the necessary or some checks that keeps it from being abusive. Now, to believe that then makes it a system. Good night. What's happened to my time? Anyway, that process now that makes it a supreme kind of thing is almost central and continuous from the beginning. So constitutionalism, the thing that all of us believe in, is the secular ideology that makes sure the Constitution is supreme. So not only do we have a Supreme Court, we have a Supreme Court that permits us now to make constitutionalism believable. And constitutionalism is secular because it believes, and this is really what the three brethren were talking about, it keeps them out. Now, what I wanted to say very quickly, my goodness, I wanted to say that the Constitution only has, in that First Amendment, only has one statement that excludes it. But constitutionalism makes it almost impossible for religious leaders to get involved. I noted in Elder Oak's article, and what I really need to say here is that these two control institutions are different about how they approach the behavior of people and the way people support it. A Supreme Court justice said about these, it says, speaking of the court, we are final. This is this supremacy. We are supreme and final because we are not final because we are infallible, but we are infallible because we're final. Now, what that is saying then, this supremacy that we're talking about, the court acknowledges, but it makes no claim, perilous, like the church does. This, the exclusion of the infallible from the secular state is not stated in the First Amendment, but is included in constitutionalism. As Elder Oaks notes in his article, not even religious leaders are excluded from the political arena. The amendment only prohibits the establishment of religion. The caution and the ambivalence, however, which I sense that Elder Oaks recommends, and in his article you ought to read it, he wants us all, he wants the religious leaders to have access and to get into the system. He seems to suggest a kind of risk that might be involved. I think there are a lot. Let me state them. Risk number one, tarnishing the image of the church. In the political arena, all the conflicting interests of society identify the opponents. The church leader will be one. He does not shed his church identity when he enters the arena. Thus, the church divinity cannot avoid being scarred, as the scarring is a secular tarnish from the arena. Risk two, the tarnishing of the image of the church leader. The secular political arena, as Elder Oaks notes, is characterized by its distinctive rough and tumble, no rules behavior. As a politician accurately warned, if you get in a mud fight, you're bound to get dirty. The church leader in politics cannot avoid the secular mud tarnishing of his spiritual calling. Risk three, abusing the devoted member's faith. The faithful member identifies with the divine spiritual mission of the church. When the church leader enters politics, whether he admits it or not, he intends to use the member's religious faith in achieving his political purposes. In so doing, he abuses the faith of the member, and his faith and his member's faith will either be threatened or secularized. Risk four, achieving success. It might win. Once a leader is in the arena of elected official, he or she must behave like any other secular leader, doing what is necessary to get elected and or remain in office. Once an issue is identified in the political arena, the issue is secularized. The church's claim on the issue vanishes. Risk five, the church is becoming a political target. When the church leader enters the political arena, the church becomes a possible target, distorting the issues. The citizen often takes a side either for or against the church, losing sight of the issues. The church, too, may become a target of a court suit in the current litigious society. These secular risks may be too much or too many for the church leaders. The religious does not mix with the secular. The political kingdom does not fit the modern church. Finally, we're going to run out of time now, Henry. It must be noted that the state, the one relocated by the Constitution from those 13 points and justified and promoted by its ideology, constitutionalism, is like any other of the 170 nations or states of the world. This human institution with ultimate secular control over life and property exists by the power necessary finally to impose it. This feature presents in all laws involved in and promotes the state into any life or property threatening conflict. This makes the state, any state, an inescapable institution and makes confrontation with it inevitable. The state's secular finality feature is to politics what God is to religion, and gives the state four inescapable characteristics that intrude and pervade all societies. The Constitution did not alter this feature, even though it made the system more accessible and by its checks hoped to control the abuses. First, the state is jealously competitive about power and income. All social efforts to control family, business, church, education, all those, may compete and not escape the state's power and finality. The example, even family controls risk being termed legal child abuse. Spousal conflicts risk being termed legal spouse abuse. Medical and legal services risk malpractice suits. The state always competes by first claim on income through taxation. Second, the state is hostile. It acquires this feature from the conflicts that give life to politics. The state's prime function about conflicts make it unfriendly. The state also promotes hostility through taxes. Third, the state is adversarial. The judicial process demands and thrives on identifying and admitting an opponent. The legislative process, though through committees, invites opposing responses. Election of governmental officials becomes interesting by intense rival interest group campaigns. Fourth, the state is punitive. As noted earlier, law is the tool of the state, and law is made effective by punishment. The finality element is completed when punishment is imposed on the violator. The constitutional procedure that validates lawmaking does not deny punishment, but ensures that punishment shall not be cruel or unusual. The distinctive feature of the constitutional system is not the creation of a different kind of a state, but the wide popular majority accesses to it. These are ensured by the procedures through which laws are created and validated, and it is from these procedures that organized religion is excluded. These built-in controls are the unique contribution of the secular constitution system, not religion, as the three Ensign Articles claim. These three Ensign Articles stimulated by claiming that religion is the legitimizing power of the U.S. constitutional system. They base their claims on the 1833 revelations that praise the Constitution primarily, quote, for supporting the principles of freedom in maintaining rights and privileges that belong to all mankind, and protect and giving divine moral agency that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment, unquote. Those are from two sections. The revelations most likely were referring to the First Amendments, religion, speech, and all of those. These amendments, however, which initially excluded religion from the national political system, now, 200 years later, through constitutional law and the nagging decisions, excludes religion from the entire system. Thus, even though the amendment of the Revelations agreement about freedom, the 160-year-old Revelations, are still in conflict with the secular, neutral constitution. The claim is for divinity violates the secular principle, the secular supremacy of the Constitution, as the revelations are from a Mormon God and a Mormon theology, violating the secular and the neutrality of the constitutional law. Only a secular Supreme Court constitution could provide the kind of power necessary to grant religious freedom. The same problem confronts Elder Oak's absolute religious values, which he claims to be essential for politics and law. These two are in conflict with the secular constitutional system. Elder Oaks must have noted this conflict when earlier, through church leaders, announced plural marriage was a divinely inspired absolute principle. Regardless of the claim, the secular Supreme Court constitutional system forbade the practice, rejecting the religious source. Elder Oaks knows, as does every citizen, that constitutional procedures, not moral claims, make and validate laws. He also knows that a maze of conflicting moral claims struggle through the political processes. He is not likely, however, to claim that law makes morality, even though he hopes, along with all citizens, that laws are just. Justice, like freedom, is a moral concept. Both are nearly always involved in all political conflicts. A political resolution of the conflicts makes law. Unless Elder Ballard has his own definition of constitutional law, he may have difficulty insisting that God is in its source. This will be especially difficult when the court, the constitutional, insists that it is secular and neutral. Elder Faust may have a problem discovering a secularism to his liking, since the claim that secularism is a protected religion has been rejected by the Supreme Court. There is, however, as noted earlier, a secular non-religious ideology, constitutionalism, which is secularism itself, that promotes constitutional supremacy. It is this political secularism that is in conflict with religious political ideologies. The secular belief, too, denies the church an exclusive claim of political morality. The secular religious church-state discussion is quite familiar, yet confusing to Latter-day Saints. On Sunday, and in the Scriptures, the faithful church members read in the Book of Mormon the accounts of continuous political wars with church leaders directing the armies. The Old Testament reflects the same kind of religious political conflicts. The Doctrine and Covenants uses similar language about supreme power, not distinguishing the religious from the political controls. Latter-day Saints are accustomed to scriptures that relate to the pursuit of the kingdom of God, not distinguishing its political implication. This implies a religious constitution for Sunday discussion, but one for other days. According to constitutionalism, religious freedom is possible only when the political system is secular and neutral. It seems equally clear that if there is a non-religious source of truth, the quest for it is possible only in a secular, neutral, protected political non-religious system. Secularism, the belief that organized religion and its leaders should be excluded from the political arena, becomes critical to the constitutional system for the survival of established religion, and the hundreds of them, and the free exercise thereof. I do not join with the three apostles in their lament of the loss of political power, nor do I prefer a religious Mormon constitution. I prefer the secular one. And I believe that only with it the New Testament Jesus and his current diverse followers could survive. I also believe that a modern Jesus could accept secular constitutionalism. For he excluded Jesus, that is, he excluded Caesar's state from his kingdom. Politics was not a claim, was not a claimed power source for the controls in Jesus' kingdom. I hope I didn't disturb or threaten too much. I hope you had a good time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for attending this session. Copies of his paper are available. He'll give them to you for the cost of duplication, $2.50. And you will also be able to purchase a cassette of his presentation. Thank you again. Which? From this man. Thank you very much.